Mount Cuba Center supports WHYY and hosts the annual Wildflower Celebration, Sunday, April 26th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., featuring garden demonstrations, live entertainment, and native woodland wildflowers at their peak. Open to the public. Mount Cuba Center is a botanical garden located in Hockessin, Delaware, that promotes the conservation of native plants. More on the Wildflower Celebration, course offerings, and visiting hours at mountcubacenter.org. That's mtcubacenter.org.
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Ahead this evening, we'll question the ethics of employees spiking in the ailing pension systems of many Pennsylvania towns. First, expansion plans for Philadelphia International Airport cleared a major hurdle today as city officials agreed to terms for land use compensation and resident relocation. WHYY's Steve Trader was on hand for the document signing ceremony.
Since 2007, neighboring Tinicum Township, Delaware County, and the Interborough School District have not received tax revenue from the airport. Now, they will divide $1.8 million annually. Residents will not have to move, and the city will lease land from the township for $1 million a year. The deal settles a 2009 lawsuit and clears a major barrier to the multi-year, multi-billion dollar project. Delco Council Chairman Mario Severo was relieved.
I think at the end of the day it was a decent settlement. I really do. People weren't being asked to leave. They weren't going to condemn, so it worked out.
Next comes FAA approval, then negotiations with the airlines, says airport CEO Mark Gale.
You know, I'll acknowledge that there's many more pieces that still need to be addressed, but this was one step in the process, and I'm very happy that we were able to come to agreement with our friends and neighbors in Tinicum Township and Delaware County.
The airport is already expanding one runway, but will add another, build more hangars, relocate a UPS facility, and upgrade terminals. The plan could take up to 15 years to implement completely. For WHYY News, I'm Steve Trader.
Philadelphia's police department, like many others around the country, is in the midst of a push to purchase more body cameras. The department will buy 450 wearable cameras next year, with plans to outfit all city officers by the year 2019. Though, as WHYY's Bobby Allen notes, some public defenders are raising concerns, contending more police footage might not mean more accountability.
At a December event unveiling Philly's body camera pilot program, Officer James Samuel showed off the new gadget, about the size of an old iPhone.
This particular camera has a view, so you can see, so the public also can see that they're being recorded at the same time that we're on here. It's on record now.
The department is hailing the cameras as a way to curb frivolous lawsuits and bring more transparency to police interactions. But not all criminal justice observers want the cameras.
I have yet to see in all of my research a really well thought out, these are how we're going to deal with the privacy concerns.
Harvard Law student Katie McCarthy has been studying the implications of body cameras. She says public defenders are split on the issue.
If you watch body camera footage, it can be very confusing. And I'm not sure it's going to lead to, you know, these crystal clear images that tell a one-sided story.
The cameras are worn around an officer's neck. Fast movement can distort footage. And of course, the devices can be turned on and off. But when they're rolling, there are things that are raising alarms among privacy advocates.
These are frequently going to be intimate interactions, and they're going to be often people sort of in their worst moments. And so I think you have concerns about the individuals who are featured on the film, which may or may not also be the suspects, and whether they want that shared.
Call her a cynical public defender, but McCarthy says body cameras could, in fact, aggravate problems with the criminal justice system. She's worried that footage will be released in an incomplete way and prosecutors will make it public only when it helps them get a conviction. Then there's the side to the discussion that sounds a little creepy. McCarthy found that in countries that are farther along with body cameras, like in the UK and Canada, police can digitally identify people and run those IDs against outstanding warrant lists and databases for things such as child support obligations.
And they've now perfected an essentially instantaneous facial recognition software that pulls from, you know, criminal databases, it pulls from Facebook, it pulls from various social media, and it pulls from the body camera footage, and they can identify people real time on the ground.
Philly's program isn't that sophisticated yet, but McCarthy says it could get there. Before it does, though, privacy ground rules need to be set out, she says. John Dye Harrell runs a resource center for those recently released from prison. He says if a bad guy knows a police officer is wearing a camera, violence is less likely.
But if there's a situation where it's on film, anyone in the public could see it, then that will lay a lot of the fears.
As the technology spreads, another question is, who will pay for storing all this footage? One proposed law in New Jersey has a novel suggestion, making criminals foot the bill through higher fines. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
Last month, FEMA agreed to reopen up to 144,000 flood insurance claims from Superstorm Sandy victims who contend they weren't paid enough for their damage. The widening scandal has focused so far on engineering reports that were allegedly rewritten to reduce or deny coverage. And NJ Spotlight's Scott Gurian reports there may be a much larger issue with insurance adjuster estimates. Those problems could be harder to prove.
As a general contractor who specializes in insurance repairs, Larry Steimel has had a front row seat to some of the problems people have had rebuilding their homes. Take the case of Judy Hickerson, one of his clients who lives in Waretown, just south of Toms River. Her insurer sent an adjuster from a company called Colonial Claims, but Steimel says they calculated the damage at about half of what it should have been by cutting corners wherever they could. For instance, he estimated it would cost more than $5,000 to clean and repair the siding on Hickerson's flooded home.
The insurance company gave nothing for siding. I think for the most part, all they would allow for was a pressure washing on the outside of the house. But meanwhile, it was submerged in salt water, which is corrosive and very damaging to plywood sheathing and so on and so forth.
The adjuster's estimate also didn't include coverage for exterior paint, and it didn't account for sales tax. Steimel says there's no way he could have rebuilt this house the way they suggested.
What would be wrong with that would be a house that, one, is contaminated when you get involved in stormwater. Not cleaning that could have caused health problems. And two, they would start to see defects in the house. The wood starts to show the warping, the nails are rusted out, the siding starts to pop. So it would have been a substandard job, and the overall effect would have been it was also unhealthy.
Colonial didn't respond to a request for comment. Hickerson's insurance company, Wright Flood, sent a short statement pledging to review complaints from any of its policyholders. Donald Griffin with PCI, an insurance industry trade group, says that such disputed settlements are generally the exception to the rule.
There's always the feeling that insurance companies are trying to slight the customer in some way. What I can tell you is that's not the case.
He notes that flood insurance, unlike other types of insurance, is paid using federal taxpayer money. So private adjusters and companies processing the claims would have no financial incentive to shortchange their customers. Critics acknowledge that's true, and while they have a number of theories, no one knows for sure exactly why this is happening. Recent attention has focused on insurance companies doctoring engineering reports to reduce payouts, but Chip Merlin, an attorney representing hundreds of Sandy victims in New Jersey, says such reports only impact a small number of cases. He thinks there's a much bigger problem with adjuster estimates.
100% of all claims have estimates. If you can't trust the engineering report, why should you trust the estimate? And everybody's got an estimate.
As a result of the engineering scandal, FEMA has asked insurance companies to turn over drafts of all inspection reports to see if anything was changed to wrongfully deny policyholders coverage. But with the insurance estimates, there's often no similar paper trail. Most of the concerns revolve around how the estimates were written in the first place, so it could be harder to prove there was any wrongdoing. Amy Bach with United Policyholders, an insurance consumer advocacy group, says that's why she's eagerly awaiting the details of how FEMA will conduct its review of cases.
They're going to have to be mechanical about it and look at things like, was sales tax withheld? Was overhead and profit improperly withheld? Were the allowances for paint accurate to the actual cost of paint in that area at that time?
That's nitpicky, time-intensive work, she says. But if it doesn't get done, then the reopening of these flood claims won't make much of a difference. For WHYY, I'm Scott Gurian.
That report comes to us as part of our Sandy Rebuild collaboration with WNYC and NJSpotlight.com. Public education funding in Pennsylvania is one of the most sustained, debated, and reported topics on our air, but talking points often overshadow the nuanced variables comprising this complex issue. To shed light, WHYY and our statewide reporting project Keystone Crossroads have launched a new podcast. It hopes to provide the context and insight that daily headlines can't capture. Joining me now is WHYY senior education reporter Kevin McCurry to talk about Multiple Choices. It's a podcast he hosts that pulls back the curtain on issues of schools and money in Pennsylvania. Kevin, what's the goal?
Dave, we really want to dig into those issues, like you said, that are facing people in Pennsylvania just a bit deeper than we can on a daily basis. So in this podcast, we're talking to and about the people making decisions about education. It's parents, teachers, unions, school leaders, lawmakers. We want to give them all the most detailed information possible to make the best decisions about how public ed can best serve the state's students. That's why it's called Multiple Choices, because there's often so many sides to these issues.
And the first episode debuts today. What's it about?
Well, we delve into the idea of public education equity, right? Should we strive to give all students the access to the same resources? And is that even possible? On this point, a recent AP study found that the gap between what the state's wealthiest and poorest school districts meant that the wealthy district spent $4,000 more on each child in that school. Here's Paul Sokolar, editor and publisher of the Philadelphia Public School Notebook, who joins me on the podcast.
Think about that $4,000 per pupil. If you've got a classroom average size of 25 kids, you're talking $200,000 in the classroom. That's really enough to pay for another highly paid professional.
Episode one. Kevin, what's the scope of the project and where can we find them?
We have one out so far, and that's on KeystoneCrossroads.org. We have another 8 in the pipeline. Next one will be out on Friday. But in general, yeah, we're digging into teacher compensation, the debate about charter schools, special education funding, malfeasance, cyber education, and much, much more. So if you have kids in public schools in Pennsylvania, or you just want to get a better understanding of how your state tax dollars are spent, this Multiple Choices podcast is definitely for you.
Thanks, Kevin.
Thank you, Dave.
WHYY senior education reporter Kevin McCurry on NewsWorks Tonight. And again, the Multiple Choices podcast is now available to stream and download on KeystoneCrossroads.org. Turning to this evening's headlines, a federal judge in Philadelphia today approved an estimated $1 billion settlement for retired NFL players with neurocognitive illnesses. The final agreement sets no dollar limit, though it does establish caps for payments to individual players based on age, time in the league, and other variables. The NFL players' attorney, Christopher Seeger, warned that the only thing that could derail the settlement at this point would be players filing objections.
The NFL will not begin to implement the program until they have the deal is 100% final, and that doesn't occur until the appeals either exhaust or they don't occur. So if there are no appeals in 30 days, we'll begin to implement the settlement and begin to get benefits to people.
And if no appeals are filed, Seeger says retired players could start seeing payments by the end of the summer. The agreement compensates retired players who suffer from illnesses tied to concussions, including Alzheimer's, ALS, and dementia. St. Joseph's University has chosen a lay leader for the first time in its 164-year history. Philadelphia native Mark Reed will become president starting July 1st. He's currently senior VP and chief of staff at Fairfield University in Connecticut. Both Fairfield and St. Joe's are private Jesuit schools. 55 degrees, cloudy skies on Independence Mall. It's 6:18. You're listening to NewsWorks Tonight on WHYY. Still a chance of a shower this evening and then clearing skies overnight, low 38 degrees. Tomorrow, partly sunny, breezy. Thursday's high 56. Friday, plenty of sunshine, high again in the mid-50s. Still ahead, a boy learns the art of stained glass in order to honor his mentor.
She never really assumed that I'd be that interested because it takes a lot of work and patience. It's not something that like 10 or 11-year-olds have a lot of, I think.
NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY.
University Medical Center of Princeton proudly supports WHYY and is proud to offer minimally invasive robotic surgery with the Da Vinci surgical system, so surgeons are able to perform delicate procedures with enhanced vision, precision, and control, with the goal of providing patients with minimal pain, less scarring, and faster recovery. Learn more about robotic surgery at PrincetonHCS.org or at 1-888-742-7496.
Dance Celebration supports WHYY and presents the Dancer Athletes of Pylobolis and their gravity-defying, rule-breaking choreography. Seen previously at the Oscars and the Olympics, Pylobolis returns to Philadelphia with new works. Pylobolis, May 7th through 10th at the Annenberg Center. Details at 215-898-3900 or annenbergcenter.org. 215-898-3900 or annenbergcenter.org.
Supporting WHYY, the Rutgers School of Business at Camden encourages working professionals in the region to take the next step in their career by earning a master's degree. The Rutgers University Professional MBA and the Professional Master's in Accounting degrees are accelerated programs designed for working professionals, with classes held on Saturdays in Cherry Hill. An information session is at 9 a.m. on Saturday, May 9th at the Cherry Hill Library. Details at pmba.rutgers.edu or 856-225-2700.
Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. At the end of 2011, the city of Allentown endured a gaping hole in its fire department. No, not a literal hole. 43 of its firefighters retired at once. Not only did the city lose that wisdom and experience, but suddenly it owed millions of dollars more every year in retirement benefits it couldn't afford. Mariel Segarra offers this story on as part of Keystone Crossroads series on Pennsylvania's underfunded pensions.
What drove 43 city firefighters out of their jobs? A contract, a generous labor contract awarded under the previous mayor that was about to expire. The firefighters wanted to lock in their benefits, including their pensions, before that contract became less generous. John Strabula is the president of Allentown's Firefighters Union. He retired in 2011 when he was 47 years old. Strabula says he loved being a firefighter, that he still dreams about it, and his heart aches when he sees the other firefighters respond to emergencies without him. But he says the benefits were too good to pass up.
I probably would have had to work another 6, 7, 8, 9 years to get to the same pension that I was at, and if I were to become injured, that wouldn't be possible.
One of the perks of the contract was that it made it possible for firefighters to spike their pensions. Spiking is when a city worker puts in a lot of overtime at the end of his or her career in order to get more money in retirement. Some labor contracts allow overtime to count towards a worker's pension, and some don't. In Allentown, it did. When someone was out sick or on vacation, the firefighters would get calls asking if they wanted to fill in. Strabula usually turned down those calls. But at the end of his career, he started saying yes and working a lot of overtime.
I probably increased my pension 20%, maybe 25% of what it would have been.
In some cases, employees who spike end up taking home more in retirement than they did when they were working. Spiking can be a big problem for cities because by nature, it's unexpected. That means it's hard for the city to account for when investing in its pension system. And municipal pension plans are in trouble. Here's Auditor General Eugene DePasquale at a press conference in January. He's pointing emphatically to a map of the more than 560 Pennsylvania municipalities that don't have enough money to pay their pension obligations.
Without a comprehensive statewide fix, all of these areas are going to be confronted with tax increases and or cuts to public safety.
Lawmakers and regulatory officials say spiking is part of that problem, but no one measures exactly how much it happens or how much it's costing cities across the state. As a sampling, in Harrisburg and Philadelphia, all city workers except for police and firefighters are able to spike. But in Reading and Lancaster, none of the labor contracts allow spiking. We asked readers what they think of spiking. Some called it unfair. One person said employees who spike their pension should be publicly shamed. John Emmons, who lives in New London Township, made an ethical appeal.
People still know the difference between right and wrong, and they should be able to judge whether what they're doing is really right or opportunistic.
But John Strabula, the union president, says he's not ashamed, because at the end of the day, he answers to his family.
You talk to other people in the private sector, and they admonish us, oh, you know, your pension. And I say to them, oh, you're the one. You're the one that wouldn't have done it. You would have placed your priorities for the taxpayer above your own family. Well, don't ever say that in front of your family, because I don't think they'd appreciate it.
Strubula says he and the other firefighters had the opportunity to work so much overtime because Allentown didn't hire enough people to meet the department's minimum staffing requirements. While we're on the topic of blame, under state law, it's actually illegal for most Pennsylvania cities to give this benefit to their police and fire employees. But cities do it anyway, and there's no public agency in charge of stopping them. Why would a city give workers the opportunity to spike? Jim McEnany is the executive director of the Public Employee Retirement Commission. He says elected officials sometimes offer the benefit in lieu of higher salaries.
If I include the money in your paycheck, I'm going to have to pay it out of this year's budget. If I include it in the pension instead, it's going to be somebody else's problem down the road.
McEnany says politicians also agree to allow spiking in exchange for support in elections. Ed Pawlowski, the mayor of Allentown, says it's a problem that pension benefits are decided during collective bargaining. He hopes for a statewide system for municipal pensions.
If we don't address these functional issues on a statewide level, we are going to see municipality after municipality in the state fall like dominoes on a board.
As for Allentown, the city tackled its $160 million pension debt by leasing out its water system to a private company. The firefighters' 2012 labor contract makes it almost impossible for them to spike their pensions. That contract is up again this year. Marielle Segarra, Keystone Crossroads.
Keystone Crossroads is a statewide public media initiative reporting on challenges facing Pennsylvania cities. WHYY leads the four-station partnership. A University of Pennsylvania hospital in Philadelphia has installed new stained glass windows created by a boy as a bar mitzvah project. From WHYY's Arts and Culture desk, Peter Crimmins reports that the boy was inspired by a friend who died in its hospice center.
The Penn Hospice Center in Rittenhouse Square opened its new children's room with a small reception. The room is intended for children and teenagers visiting loved ones who are approaching the end of their lives. It features everything from bereavement counseling to an Xbox. It needed an upgrade, says Jerry Tim, the director of volunteer services.
Instead of just a plain wall with some pictures on it, we said, let's pick a theme and make it fun and engaging. We picked a jungle theme.
So there's a rainforest mural splashed across two walls, and on a third is a stained glass window made by David Lerner Wagner. He's 13 years old.
A good friend of ours named Lois Ruth, she was into stained glass, and she told my mom that she had cancer. She came here towards the end.
Ruth was a family friend of David and his parents. He'd known her since he was 6 months old.
She was really pleasant, very optimistic. She was a counselor at Frankfort High School. She played the organ and was a choir director of the Philadelphia district. When she was getting a little older, she decided to do a lot of stained glass work. Her house was filled with music and glass and cats.
After she died, David spent a year making a window out of the leftover material he found in her house. He says Ruth died before he could learn any of her stained glass techniques.
She never really assumed that I'd be that interested because it takes a lot of work and patience. It's not something that like 10 or 11-year-olds have a lot of, I think.
This is David's first completed stained glass window. The jungle scene measures 8 feet by 4 feet, so it's an ambitious tribute to his friend and mentor. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov and Kimberly Haas, with help today from Brett Rader. Listen again to a story or catch up on a missed show via podcast or online at newsworks.org. Tomorrow evening, we'll look at a Pennsylvania program that gives scholarships to get kids out of poorly performing schools. What's not to like? Well, some say the hefty tax credit that funds the program causes more problems than it cures. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.
People's Light presents Biloxi Blues, April 29th to May 24th.
This semi-autobiographical Tony Award-winning play by American comedic genius Neil Simon follows the adventures of Eugene Morris Jerome as he is shipped off to boot camp during World War II, a classic coming-of-age tale told with wit, heart, and humor. For tickets, peopleslight.org or 610-644-3500. People's Light supports WHYY.
Thomas Jefferson School of Population Health supports WHYY. At Jefferson, health is all they do, and public health is a big part of it. Jefferson School of Population Health offers a fully accredited Master of Public Health degree. Classes begin in September, and merit scholarships are available. An information session will be held on Tuesday, May 12th at 5:30 p.m. For details or to register, online at jefferson.edu/publichealthinfo. Thomas Jefferson School of Population Health.